Because of his ungodly behavior, Moses forfeited his right to enter the Promised Land. As a result, the Israelites were without a leader. Who would step in for Moses and lead the people forward? Happy New Year from Insight for Living. On today's program, Chuck Swindoll points to the moment when Moses stepped down, and he explains how this transfer of leadership provides a model for us today. What are the traits we should look for in a qualified candidate? How do we refrain from getting ahead of the process? Chuck titled his message, Filling the Shoes of Moses.
I want to talk this evening about a subject that is seldom considered from a pulpit, and yet when you work your way through a book of Scripture or through a life like we are in Moses, you come across at certain junctures things that you would not normally present. That's the beauty of an expository pulpit ministry. God directs you to say things that He once said as He simply brings them to pass in the life or in the book under study. We've come to our next to last study in the life of Moses. And they have been helpful in my life, and as I hear from various ones of you, they've been helpful in yours. And I thank God with you. Tonight I want to talk about the whole area of filling the shoes of a great man or great woman. Now, many of you are in school. A number of you are engaged in ministries, in administrative capacities, and you will be running for office, or you will be looking for replacements in particular positions of responsibility. And I think God has some things to say to us about the whole matter of filling the shoes of someone that's done a good job. And by the way, that's an unenviable position to be in. Can you think of the individual's feelings who took the place of Peter Marshall in Washington, D.C.? You can't even name him, can you? I can't either. How about the one who took the place of Donald Barnhouse, that great Presbyterian church in Philadelphia? How about the one who stepped in the shoes of Henrietta Mears? You don't even know who he was, do we? Or how about the one who took the place of Harry Ironside or G. Campbell Morgan, or sat in the faculty chair in place of Robert Dick Wilson or Gretchen Machen? What about people who served following great individuals? It's true in the military. Who took the place in Korea of Douglas MacArthur when Truman called him home? Before God, I could not tell you who that was. Who stepped in after Churchill when he phased out? Isn't it something how the individual who steps in the shoes of another often is forgotten, but is quite frequently very capable? Let me give you a couple of examples. Dawson Trotman founded the Navigators. He was a man of great discipline, a man of tremendous enthusiasm and determination, vision. He set up the whole follow-up ministry of the Graham Crusade. He himself set it in motion. And it follows in as a legacy to his life. And God gave him the direction of the Navigators, which is a Christian organization trained to recruit, disciple, and send young men and women to the world. That's their vision. Well, in God's plan, He called him home at the young age of 50. He drowned in an accident, humanly speaking, up at Scroon Lake when he was just 50 years young. And the man God chose as his replacement is a fellow named Lauren Sanney, who is different in personality, in appearance, in physique, in style, in expressions. The whole framework, the whole structure of his fiber is different. And who would have thought that a Sanney would follow a Trotman? Certainly not Sanney. You should talk to him about that. Well, he would want to go in the opposite direction when they came and said, "We feel God has placed you on the heart of this work." As a matter of fact, it's interesting, when Trotman died, he had already talked to his wife and said he had a premonition of death, and so they sat down and together mapped out the whole plan of the Navigators for the future before he ever died. Sort of like buying the nails for your coffin before it's ever built, isn't it? But it happened. Let me mention one more, the ministry of Richard Sumi, who has been in this pulpit on an occasion. He filled the pulpit of Emmanuel Baptist Church for over 12 years and did a magnificent job. He's a devotional speaker. He's eloquent, tall and dark, and in his day of great health, he was a very handsome and winsome person, an evangelist at heart, and a heartwarming speaker. And then in God's marvelous providence, he reached down and plucked him from Emmanuel Baptist and put him at the Wheaton Bible Church. Suddenly, I mean, to the surprise of everyone, especially the people at Emmanuel in Richmond, Virginia. And they waited and waited and waited for God's man. And finally, God called Dr. Stanley Toussaint, a name that I doubt a handful of you would even know, a man who was very instrumental in the shaping of my own mind in the area of the New Testament language. But here he came. He wasn't tall and dark and handsome. He was, as a matter of fact, a short, rather stumpy appearance. And in fact, in his earlier years, he had a bout with polio. He was crippled. He walks with a limp. He's not a devotional speaker. He's a teacher, rather pedantic. He's not winsome in the sense of Sumi, but he is altogether committed to the Word of God. And God used his life for several years at Richmond. Now, what I'm saying is that those individuals who step in the shoes of great men and great women are often very different, but nevertheless appointed by God to do the job that is to be done. Frequently, God changes the direction of an organization. It can happen in a mission. For example, when Hudson Taylor was moved from the China Inland Mission by death, could you even name who took his place? But the one who took its place reshaped the whole mission. In other words, God used a successor in the wake of a very successful predecessor to do a whole new work. Now, I don't know God's plan for your life, neither do you. But for all you know, He is training you and shaping you to step in and serve as an officer or as a board member or as a student body leader in some capacity, in the shoes of someone who has done a bang-up job. And you're different. And you're going to see that God can use it, even though you're different, in a remarkable way. Let's begin by turning to Numbers chapter 20. I want to talk about the replacement in the life of Moses, a man by the name of Joshua. Now, as you listen to those thoughts to begin with, you might have wondered, well, why couldn't Moses go on into the land of Canaan? Why was it that this man who had led the people for four decades, who had been instrumental in the lives of, countless miracles in the lives of people, as well as miracles in the surface of the earth, as water came from the rock and as waters were open in the sea and as the plagues had been given through his hand into the life of Pharaoh, why wouldn't God let that man go on into Canaan? Let me just call your attention to verse 8 down through a few more verses in chapter 20 of Numbers. God said to Moses, Take the rod, you and your brother Aaron, assemble the congregation and speak to the rock before their eyes, that it may yield its water. You shall thus bring forth water for them out of the rock and let the congregation and their beasts drink. Now that's clear instruction. Moses, take the rod, speak to the rock, and water will come out to water the animals and to quench the thirst of the people. But Moses was very impatient. Verse 9, it says, he took the rod from before the Lord, just as he had commanded him, so far so good. But Moses and Aaron gathered the assembly before the rock, and Moses said to them, listen now, you rebels. Now here's an extra sermon that God hadn't prepared. Here is a hammer that Moses was going to use to beat them over their heads. And in doing so, he took the glory from heaven and he wore it for a few awful moments and thereby forfeited his right into the land. He says, you rebels, shall we bring forth water for you out of this rock? We, that's blasphemy. We never brought water. God alone brings water. We never bring blessing. God brings blessing through us. But he was angry, and so he took that rod, and he struck the rock twice with his rod, and in grace, water came out abundantly. But the Lord got him aside, you will remember, And he said, Moses, because you did this, you took the glory upon yourself. No way. You will not go into the land, verse 12 tells us. You will not bring the assembly into the land. Why couldn't Moses go in? Not just because he struck the rock, not just because he lost his temper for the umpteenth time, but because Moses took the glory that belonged to the Lord and he tarnished it publicly. God said, no, that's enough, Moses. You're going to be replaced. There's got to be someone else. Heart-rending time. Another question is, who would be qualified to take Moses' place? Look back at chapter 14 for another few moments, and let's land on verse 26. They've come to the edge of Canaan. Just before entering the land, they sent spies in, and the spies came back and said, as a majority report, no way are we going to be able to take the land. There are giants in the land. And God was so displeased with the people. Verse 26, he spoke to Moses and Aaron, saying, how long shall I bear with this evil congregation? We're in Numbers 14, 27. This evil congregation grumbling against me. I have heard the complaints of the sons of Israel, which they are making against me. Say to them, as I live, says the Lord, just as you have spoken in my hearing, so I will surely do to you. Your corpses shall fall in the wilderness, even all your numbered men, according to your complete number, from 20 years old and upward, and who have grumbled against me. Surely you shall not come into the land which I swore to settle you, except, now here are the possibilities, Caleb, circle that name, and Joshua, circle that name. Who was qualified to take Moses' place? Only two men who had had the experience for those years past of training at the feet of Moses and learning from God's hand in the lives of the people. Caleb and Joshua. Now, some people wonder, why didn't God put Caleb in as Moses' replacement? Why Joshua? Well, take a moment and look back at 11:28. Just one more verse before we get into chapter 27. You'll see the reason, more than likely, that God chose Joshua. Then Joshua, the son of Nun, the attendant of Moses from his youth, answered and said, Moses, my Lord, restrain them. The part that is of interest is he was an attendant of Moses from his youth. Caleb was as godly a man, certainly as qualified a man, but he had not been honed and discipled, to use our word, trained by Moses. Think of what it must have been like to have been Moses' servant from your younger years. By the way, that's how they used to train men for the ministry. A man who was preparing for the ministry did not often go to seminary years ago. He simply moved into the life and home of an older, more experienced minister. And he imbibed the principles of godliness, the disciplines of study, prayer, the wisdom of dealing with knotty problems related to the ministry, the direction involved in leading a congregation. He learned that by rubbing shoulders over an extended period of time, not always the same amount of time. G. Campbell Morgan's life was characterized by training younger men at his footstool, as it were, for a period of time and then releasing them to the ministry. You know, that's not a half bad plan. Seminaries are realizing it today, and they therefore encourage internships where their students are involved in ministries firsthand with the lives of pastors and pastoral staffs, so as to gain this kind of experience. That's why Joshua was qualified rather than Caleb. He had been trained for the task. Now, he didn't know he was being trained to take Moses' place. It would have scared Joshua to death to think that he was in training for Moses' job. But he was. Now, look at chapter 27. Chapter 27 is based on one basic principle. I want to lay it on you, and then we'll see it as it works out in the passage. Here's the principle. When a man of God dies, nothing of God dies. When a man of God is moved on to another position, nothing of God moves on. It is terribly easy for a person who is used of God to become God's replacement in the minds of people. And then when that person is moved on to another ministry or dies or fails, many of those who idolize that individual fall by the wayside. And God is teaching us in this 27th of Numbers that when he moves a man on like Moses and buries him at Mount Nebo, nothing of God is buried. He's still at work. When Donald Barnhouse passed on, nothing of God passed on in the work and ministry of 10th Memorial Presbyterian Church in Philadelphia moved right on. The same is true of those other ministries. Nothing of the Navigators suffered when Trotman was taken. Nothing of China Inland Mission suffered when Taylor was finished, because nothing of God suffers. It is so easy to be tunnel visioned rather than broad and see God at work in the lives of gifted individuals down through time. Now, we find Moses on the edge of death. Chapter 27, verse 12, we see him, first of all, viewing the land. Must have been filled with nostalgia. Look at verse 12. Then the Lord said to Moses, "Go up to this mountain of Abarim and see the land which I have given to the sons of Israel. And when you have seen it, you too shall be gathered to your people." That's an Old Testament way of saying you will die, as Aaron your brother has died. "When you have seen it, you will die." Now, as you read that, you might wrestle with feelings that God was cruel to do that. That's like having a fellow fall in love with a girl and God say, "Look, you get one final look at that girl this evening because she's going to marry somebody else tomorrow." That's like saying to a hungry dog, "Look, see this nice meal? Well, you can't have it." Well, why would God do that for Moses? Now, God is not a mocker. God is not cruel. I think we have to be broader than that. In fact, I never find Moses submerged in self-pity. I never see Moses shaking his fist saying, "Why have you done that to me?" No, God was showing Moses that he keeps his word. You see, he's been telling Moses for 40 years, "I'm going to lead them into the land." So right on the edge of the land, he told Moses to go up on that mountain, that series of mountain ranges, and look across and to see that God keeps his word. "And Moses, you forfeited the right to go into the land. You took the glory that belonged to me and you did it publicly. And I can't have that kind of man take my people into the land, but I want you to see that I keep my word." And so it was that Moses saw the land and then he shortly thereafter died. But something happened in the heart of Moses when he looked out over the land. Like I say, he had feelings of nostalgia, but they were deeper than that. He realized that the people of Israel needed a leader because in the land of Canaan were enemies. In fact, some of the arch enemies of Israel rested in the land of Canaan. As a matter of fact, they were a godless people. There are historical documents and archaeological finds that prove pornography started in Canaan, as did the whole perversion in the sexual life. It has Canaanite roots. Moses knew that. The grapevine was just as fast and just as complete in those days as is today. And Moses saw those people that were wicked to the core, and he knew in order for the people of God to be preserved from, first, from defeat in battle as well as defeat spiritually, they needed a leader. Now, you're going to read the bigness of Moses in the next few verses. Let me just read down, beginning at verse 15 through 17. Listen to a man who was unselfish enough to think ahead. "Moses spoke to the Lord, saying, 'May the Lord, the God of the spirits of all flesh, appoint a man over the congregation who will go out and come in before them, who will lead them out and bring them in, that the congregation of the Lord may not be like sheep which have no shepherd. Now, wait a minute. Before you turn the page, let's stay right here for a minute. I noticed there were two requests from Moses regarding the man. First, he requested in verse 16, the man must be God's choice. Lord, you appoint a man. One of the tendencies that strong leaders wrestle with is appointing their own successor. I've seen it happen, and I've often seen it fail, almost without exception. When a strong leader appoints his own successor, he usually appoints one very much like himself. And God's plan, as I've said earlier, is often to get a different kind of man to come and bring a whole new dimension that is that would be otherwise undeveloped. And so Moses, wise enough to see that, said, Lord, let him be your appointment. You tell me who you want. He didn't hold up to God a handful and say, choose a card. I've got four in mind. Whichever one you choose will be fine. He said, I have no suggestions. You make the man known to us and we'll appoint him. He must be a man of God's appointment. You notice what he calls the Lord, verse 16. He's the God of the spirits of all flesh. God is unlike man in that he sees the spirit. We only see the appearance. 1 Samuel 16:7, man looks on the outward appearance, the Lord looks on the heart. You remember the story of when they had to replace Saul, King Saul, the first king of Israel? Saul was tall, head and shoulders above everybody else, and he was probably very handsome, very winsome, very attractive, but he was a failure because he walked in the flesh. God removed him, and he said to Samuel, go find a replacement, Samuel. He'll be in the house of Jesse. And so Samuel rolled up his sleeves and took off for the house of Jesse, and when he got there, he saw Eliab. Eliab was the eldest in the family of Jesse, David's oldest brother. Older brothers are problems anyway, but that's another subject. He looked at Eliab, and he saw Eliab, and he said, ah, the Lord's anointed is standing before me. And the Lord said, oh, hold it. Well, that's sort of a Swindoll paraphrase. He said to Samuel something like, this is not my choice. You know what Samuel was looking for? Someone just like Saul. Eliab was Samuel's choice. And God said, no way. You back off a minute. I've got my man picked out. And he picked a fella totally unlike Saul. A little shepherd boy who was then in his teenage years, forgotten by his dad. He didn't bring him in and parade him before Samuel. Samuel had to say to Jesse, look, are these all your sons? And he says, oh, yeah, got one more guy. He's keeping the sheep. That's what happens to babies in the family, but that's another subject as well. Second thing I notice about the Lord here, verse 17, that is about the replacement, is he was to have a shepherd's heart. I like this. I like it that Moses says this. Lord, we need a man who will go out and come in among the people. He needs to realize, Lord, as he ministers in this congregation, he's got to be in touch with them. He's got to have people on his heart. God, in the heart of Moses at that point, was really working. Moses was saying, oh, we don't need a mystic. These people don't need a man of research, as important as they may be. These people need a shepherd who know people, who knows people and will minister and understand people and realize the significance of people. You know what the ministry is? It's people. You sit there tonight and you may not know me, you may not know an officer in this church, but I want you to know before God, you are special. You are important. You're in His family.
An institution doesn't embody ministry. A nonprofit organization doesn't embody ministry. As Chuck Swindoll said, ministry is people. You're listening to Insight for Living, and we're so glad you carved out a half hour from your New Year's Day celebration to join us. In just a few days from now, Chuck will conclude his in-depth biography on Moses, a man of selfless dedication. It's a classic from Insight for Living, originally presented back in 1975. And this 20-part study will end 1 week from tomorrow. Given that, you might want to access the many resources we've prepared on your behalf. First, I'll remind you that in addition to this daily teaching series, Chuck has written a full-length book on the life of Moses. It's called Moses, A Man of Selfless Dedication. It's 20 chapters long, and it's written in the engaging style you've come to expect from Chuck Swindoll. We've also prepared a brand new Bible study workbook for you. This resource is part of our Searching the Scriptures Bible Studies. It's a workbook or journal that's perfect for jotting down personal notes and observations. Many of our listeners are choosing to use this spiral-bound Bible study in their small group at church, and it's great for classroom settings as well. One more thing, this classic study on Moses was originally recorded on reel-to-reel tape, but we've transferred all 20 sermons to audio CDs so you can listen in your car, at home, or at your own pace. To purchase any or all of these helpful resources, just call us at 800-772-8888 or go online to insight.org/store. Well, last night at midnight, Insight for Living closed the books on another ministry year. But you know, it's not too late to send your much-needed contribution. If you'd like to send a donation in the mail, just write to us at Insight for Living, Post Office Box 5000, Frisco, Texas, 75034. You can also call us at 800-772-8888 or go online to insight.org/donate. I'm Bill Meyer. Join us when Chuck Swindoll continues his message called Filling the Shoes of Moses, Thursday on Insight for Living.
The preceding message, Filling the Shoes of Moses, was copyrighted in 1976, 1978, 1981, 1985, 1998, and 2024, and the sound recording was copyrighted in 2024 by Charles R. Swindoll, Inc. All rights are reserved worldwide. Duplication of copyrighted material for commercial use is strictly prohibited.